Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter, Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott. And Craig, going through the back episodes of the podcast for 2022, a theme has emerged, and that theme is discovery or untold or stories that should be told more about Florida. I'm thinking about the Ashley Gang and the Houses of Refuge and the Tamuqua Indians, May Man Jennings, Stetson Kennedy, Frank Lloyd Wright in Florida. We've had so many overlooked, important stories about Florida that have almost been lost. And we've got another one this week.
Yeah, this is maybe the most dramatic story of something that's ever happened in Florida, because it's just an incredible thing. And anyone who lived through that time remembers it. And I'm just worried that people who are now moving to the state have no idea that this happened and no idea, you know, what ramifications it had.
And I'm going to raise my hand there and give a hat tip to our friend Kathy Silvestri, who hosts the Florida Spectacular podcast, because she did an episode about the Tampa Sunshine Skyway disaster. And I listened to it. I had no idea. This was May 9th, 1980. So, which happens to be my birthday is May 9th, 1975, not 1980. But we're coming up on the anniversary here. And, you know, you talk about shifting baseline a lot with the conservation movement and development. And there's a shifting baseline with the collective memory of Florida. You know, for someone like myself who moved to the state in 2012, I had no idea. I had never heard the words Sunshine Skyway disaster. When Kathy did this episode on her podcast, my jaw was on the ground because I was like, how on earth could this event be now almost totally overlooked in this? 35 people died,
yeah,
careening off of the end of a bridge 150 feet up in the air. You'd think from time to time this would come out in the news. Now, granted, I'm over here in Amelia Island on the other side of the state, but you'd think, you know, a tragedy like this would come up just casually in conversation or the news more often.
Well, you know, but that's sort of the nature of the news in Florida, that, you know, oh my God, we had the Pulse shooting in Orlando. Oh, wait, okay, now we've got the Parkland shooting. Oh, you know, and so each time there's a disaster, it sort of pushes back the memory of the previous one.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and so new people moving in, they don't know any of that history. It's good that we're talking about this to kind of remind everyone.
Yeah, I think it's a great sort of encyclopedic service of this podcast to bring these stories back to life. And again, this is 40 years ago. I mean, there are people obviously who remember that well. Our guest, Bill DeYoung, was living in St. Petersburg at the time. He remembers it. And, you know, in 2021, looking back through the episodes of the podcast, we hit a lot of the big subjects that most people are familiar with at some level: dolphins and oranges and Disney and sea turtles and manatee and seashells and Jeffrey Epstein. But this 2022 season has really been about these lesser known stories. And this one is an absolute all-timer. Thanks, as always, to our friends at Visit Sarasota for sponsoring Welcome to Florida. April saw the U.S. Tennis Association Sarasota Open in Sarasota, and April also means the end of polo season. Yeah, the Sarasota Polo Club. The season just wrapped up in April. It runs from December through April. Sunday matches are open to the public. Now, this is something you're going to want to put on your calendar for later this year and then on into 2023. Live polo in person in Sarasota. This is hard to find anywhere around the country, let alone in Florida. A unique feature of the tourist attractions around Sarasota. Visit sarasotapolo.com for more information. And as you plan your next weekend getaway or weeks-long vacation in Sarasota, visit sarasota.com. Our guest is Bill DeYoung. You can find him online at billdeyoung.com. He is the author of the book Skyway, The True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down. He currently works with the St. Pete Catalyst. He wrote the book on a disaster and a story with victims not only on the bridge, but on the Summit Venture, the ship which struck the bridge. And at the end of the podcast today, we will hear the ship-to-shore radio call from the Summit Venture to the Coast Guard once the captain realized he had struck the bridge and the span collapsed and cars were coming over it.
It's just chilling.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness gracious. Bill DeYoung knows more about it than anyone else.
Bill, how did you get wind up doing this book? What attracted you to the story of the Skyway disaster?
I was living in Savannah at the time, and I suspect it was an anniversary. There's an anniversary every year, right? And I was reading about it, and I started getting aggravated at the fact that I would read things that didn't jibe with other things I had read. I was living here when this thing happened, and so I remembered it, as so many of us do, so very well. But I would read things that would say, the captain was drunk, and then I'd read, well, you know, he wasn't that kind of guy. And then I'd read about, for example, Mr. McIntyre's pickup truck. You would read that, oh, it had landed on the deck and rolled off the side. And then you read later, no, it smacked against the side of the ship. There was all these little things that added up to the fact that it annoyed me that it was passing into history and nobody had ever really sort of looked into the whole thing. What really happened here? And far be it from me to assume that I was the kind of guy who could do that. I'd never written a book before. But just being a journalist, I have this kind of dogged determination and, I don't take no for an answer, right? So I started looking into it. And before I knew it, I had boxes of stuff. And that's exactly how it happened. And then I realized, essentially, it came down to somebody needs to do this. I guess it's going to be me.
From your research, as opposed to what you'd read from other sources, what did you find was the real story?
Well, I think the main thing, and this has sort of been thematically a big part of what I've done as far as public speaking and actually wrote a play about it. The big thing that came out of it was the fact that Captain Laro, the harbor pilot, was exonerated in the courts. Not only was he not drunk at the time, he didn't drink alcohol. He basically got a raw deal and was, you know, made a scapegoat. And over time, he's been dead for a number of years now. But over time, his name's been dragged even further through the mud. And it feels like that's kind of the best thing that's come out of it for me. And I've spoken with his family since, and they were very hesitant about talking in the beginning anyway, because there were so many hatchet jobs about him. But they finally said, you got him right. You know, what I was talking about, Mr. McIntyre's pickup truck, his was the first vehicle to go off the bridge. He was literally cresting the bridge when it happened, rode the span down, and his truck, the reason he survived is because he didn't fall 150 feet. His truck, his widow told me, smacked into the hull and fell backwards, ricocheted off and fell backwards, sank to the bottom of the shipping channel. And he swam out, which is the famous story. He got out of his truck. And yeah, so there were little things like that. And if you go on Wikipedia or one of those places today, it still repeats some of the old stories, you know, but there's only so much one can do. That was pretty much it. Those are the big takeaways for me. And there's a lot of details. I got the whole accident report from Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, because this technically happened in Hillsborough County. And so there were these interviews with people who had gone just cleared the bridge as it happened. I found one guy who saw the ship making this turn and accelerated because he saw it coming. Mr. Hornbuckle, whose car famously stopped 14 inches from the edge. I read his whole interview with him where he talked about exactly what he'd seen and what had happened. And it was riveting stuff. And as a writer, you go, we should put this together and just tell the story, because, you know, I didn't have to make any of it up. If you might want to believe me here, but it goes with that old saying, you can't make this shit up, because it was tragic. And there was a lot of stories that never got tied into it.
One thing that surprised me in your book was reading that Captain John Laro had actually avoided an accident at the bridge prior to this incident.
Well, I think what you're referring to is that you know, Blackthorn, the Coast Guard cutter, had gone down in another tragedy near the end of January and was still there until they hadn't raised it yet. And so the shipping channel was blocked. And so they had to establish a temporary channel through a couple of the other legs, the side piers, not the main thing. Basically, it was like, you know, squeezing a ship through the eye of a needle. Mm-hmm. And Laro, Laro made 900, almost 900 safe passages back and forth under that bridge in his career. So, I mean, he wasn't a slouch. And what had happened was he was bringing a ship in and the stern of his vessel swung around, as they tend to do, and clipped one of the Skyway piers. He was lauded. Here are two things. He was lauded by the Department of Professional Regulation for wisely not knocking the bridge down. He had, whatever he did to maneuver that, it was very, very minor damage. Of course, when the Skyway came down in May, the revelation came out from the Board of Regulation that, you know, this guy had hit the Skyway before. What the hell is wrong with this guy? That was the start of his scapegoating there. And of course, they never explained exactly what had happened. Wow. You know, there's a whole thing about accident reports that every pilot, there were 18 senior pilots then, and I think 6 deputy pilots. He was just about to become a senior pilot. They, if there's an accident report, if they clip a piling, if an antenna falls off, if something happens, you need to scrape a dock, you have to file what's called an accident report, and it all goes to Tallahassee. After some adventure, after this incident happened in May, the media got hold of all the accident reports, as they are wont to do, and oh my God, John Laro had 4 or 5, including that one with the Skyway, but they didn't mention that there were several other pilots who'd had 12, 13, 14, even 17 accident mm-hmm. reports, all minor stuff. So that's what the media did, was they blew this up to, look at this guy. He's a menace. He's a menace to navigation. He's a menace to society. When he was exonerated, that's really all people remembered, were the headlines that said, look, what a bad pilot. He's terrible. He was trying to kill us the whole, you know. And that stayed with him the rest of his life.
And that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, is why did this disaster need a scapegoat? But I guess it's human nature to want to find a heel. You know, there's got to be someone to blame. So if he wasn't to blame, and 900 safe passages tells you that this guy was highly skilled, knew what he's doing. The size of these ships is enormous. We can get into that later. This is this is not like pulling the pontoon into the the dock at your local bass fishing place. So if it wasn't human error, what caused this once in a, you know, lifetime, thankfully, disaster, accident?
I tell people all the time that this was a confluence of bad mojo. This is just a confluence of a bunch of crummy, awful, terrible, lousy, miserable, horrible things happening at exactly the same time. This was what was called a macro burst. That's hiding in a it's part of a storm squall that had not been forecast. I mean, I've seen the National Weather Service forecast for that morning. They didn't say anything about this thing. This thing came in so fast, a macro burst, which they didn't even know how to describe in those days. And we can talk about that in a minute, is basically like a very powerful battery, a very powerful cell within a cell. This thing took 2 minutes to pass over Summit Venture and the Skyway Bridge, but it passed over exactly as he was coming under the bridge. Bad mojo. That's what it was. And that was proven in court. And we need to give a shout out to Steve Yared, who was John's defense attorney, who was able to prove this in court through various means and the people that he brought in to talk about what had happened. And that's how John got exonerated.
So it was a giant wind gust that blew him off course?
We're talking 70, 80 mile an hour wind gusts going back and forth in a 2 minute. It's a monster. It's a monster. And they were just starting, thank you to Roy Leap, they were just starting to work with Doppler radar at the time at WTVT over there. And Bill Kowal, God rest his soul, who took the stand for John, brought these series of color transparencies saying, you can tell the intensity of this wind only because they just had Doppler, which was able to separate it into these intensities by a color. he was able to say, look at this. You could see it moving. This is exactly when it was over his head. There were other ways they were able to tell the strength of the wind, some of which I don't remember, and some of which just be too complicated to explain. But that's what it was. It was the weather. And if any of us who were here that day remembered, it was just a really awful morning anyway. A lot of us experienced that storm as it moved over the southern part of St. Petersburg over into Hillsborough County. It moved really fast and was gone. And so to answer your question, Chad, that became, how can this guy who's essentially driving 20,000 tons of steel hit something fixed in the middle of a bay that he knew was there? Mm-hmm. That's how. It pushed his ship. It crapped. It literally blew him off. His radar was out. That's another part of the confluence of bad mojo. His radar was out. He couldn't see the bridge. He was there, and then suddenly it was gone. And by the time he kind of aligned himself, he'd been pushed out of the channel. And his, whatever that tracking thing is they have on ships, I can't remember now, didn't show it.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
And like a high profile vehicle, if you're driving an SUV over a bridge and there's a big wind gust come along, I mean, that thing, you can feel it like that. So this is an enormous ship, longer than a football field. It's heavy. It's slow. A big wind gust, again, people wonder why some of these accidents happen, or why did trains hit cars? They're not designed to stop like a passenger vehicle, or turn or steer like a passenger vehicle.
This was a 606-foot ship. It takes something that large, approximately a mile, to stop. Mm-hmm. You know, Bruce Atkins, who was Captain Lero's co-pilot, it was the first interview I did. We spent 3 days talking about this in Massachusetts, where he lives. He said that you have to, if you're a pilot or the captain of a ship, well, pilots, when they come into port, that's what they do. You have to anticipate your third move before you've done your first move. In other words, there's not a lot of give and take. In 5 minutes, I'm going to be here. I have to know what I'm going to do. In other words, and you couldn't anticipate something like this. This was a 2-minute incident. That's how fast this whole thing happened.
Tell us the story about the iconic photo of the car in front of the gap.
Yeah, Paul G. Hornbuckle, his nickname was Dick. And historically, another thing that always bugged me is in the news, they call him Richard Hornbuckle. Well, there was no Richard in his name. His name is Dick. Married 7 times. Interesting character. Went to Bible school with Billy Graham, as a matter of fact. He ran Apollo Auto Sales on US 19 here in St. Petersburg. And every couple of weeks, he would take a couple of pals, his retired old cronies, in his big Buick sedan, his 1976 Buick LeSabre, down to South Florida to pick up cars for the lot. And they'd all drive the cars back. So that's what was happening this morning. Hornbuckle's there with 3 old dudes. Well, he was an old dude too. So they're just cruising along. He remembers the Greyhound bus passing him. You know, in his deposition, he's talking about the weather. They're all talking about, I was going really, really slow because this was different. This was not just your basic spring storm. Anyway, what happened to him is he gets up to the top, and I'll tell you the whole story. He gets up to the, he's in the right-hand lane on the, this is the western span, the one going south. The guy in front of him is this guy in this little bit like a Honda Civic or something, Mr. Albritton, who worked for, I think he worked for the Times, as a matter of fact. He was a man who worked for the Independent. He was heading back to Bradenton, and he had seen it fall. And he's paralyzed with fear, stopped in the right-hand lane just before the erector set starts, just before the cantilever. And he's pounding the side of his car, trying to get people to stop. And Albritton talks about watching several cars go by and the bus go speeding by him. Now, the Greyhound bus, as we all know, was the last vehicle to go over. Hornbuckle pulls up behind him and says, what the hell's wrong with this guy? I mean, these old guys are complaining about everything, you know. The weather.
He's got to stop on the bridge. Ah.
Yeah, right. Hornbuckle described this whole thing in detail, and it was great. So he pulls up, and then he eases around into the left lane behind him. So he's going really slow, thinking he's bad tire or his car's out, whatever. He's going slow, and he says, then he realizes there's nothing in front of him. Now, bear in mind, the rain is all but stopped now. The sun is starting to come up. Hornbuckle sees nothing but black, and he slams on his brakes, and they slide down that grading, which was at a tilt at that point. Mm. The front tire is 14 inches from the edge. Can you imagine these old guys are holding their breath, right? So they stop. Oh, my God. Okay, what are we going to do? Okay, slowly open the doors. It's a four-door, these huge, Cadillac-sized doors. They get out, and they crawl up the wet grading up to the concrete. Three of them get up there, and they realize that Hornbuckle is not one of them. They look back, and he's back at the car. He's walking around very carefully, closing all the doors. He loves that car. he literally kept it until he died many years later. That's another story. He's closing the doors.
Didn't he want something out of the trunk?
Too? And that's what happened. Yes. It's the famous story. This is what happens.
Oh,
next.
My God.
They're watching him going, Dick, what the hell are you doing? And he goes back and he's got his keys out and he's going into the trunk to get his golf clubs out. He literally had a game next day. This guy was quite a character. And so they finally convince him, you really need to get out of there. And he says, okay. And he closes the trunk very carefully. It's his car, remember? And he crawls and he goes back up and he's back there. And so somebody asked him, what are you doing that for? And he said, it was just an old pair of shoes. I could let it go. But this is a good pair of golf clubs. They're going to last, And then, I through the newspaper archives, I would read about the mechanic from Harold's truck stop who had to come up, and the fire department got him to run a chain down and pull the car back. And then he drove Hornbuckle back to Apollo Auto Sales, and Hornbuckle smoked every cigarette he had, and he was nervous, and so you can just create a story out of all this. Like I said, you can't make it up.
You talk about some of the survivors. How about some of the folks who perished? You mentioned the Greyhound bus. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the loss of life, and certainly the some of the folks or the stories of people who were on that bus that went over.
26 people. On the bus. The bus had left Chicago Wednesday night. One guy was, Chad, the stories are so sad. One guy had been on it since Chicago, and people got on along the way. He was going to, I think it was Bradenton, to meet his estranged wife, who'd agreed to take him back for one more try. He had a young son, and he was kind of a screw up. And there were several students from Tuskegee College up there in Alabama. It was Mother's Day weekend, so they were coming. They all had family in Florida. They were coming back from Mother's Day weekend. Linwood Armstrong, who works for the Road Board now, the Department of Transportation, was one of those students, and he got off in Plant City and said goodbye to his friends. And all his friends died when the bus went over. And Linwood, actually, last time I spoke to him, he was working in engineering and maintenance on the Skyway Bridge, which he saw the irony in that,
Wow.
We met a gentleman from Tallahassee, Charles McGarra, who was actually a St. Petersburg native. He was 26, 27, put his 24-year-old wife and their six-month-old baby on the bus in Tallahassee. And what happened. And when we dedicated the memorial back in 2015, Mr. McGarra and Linwood too, they came and they spoke and talked about their experiences.
Where is the memorial?
The memorial is it's on the north in the northwest area. Oh, here's a story for you. It's near the Blackthorn Memorial, which is really beautiful. The Coast Guard has this great big granite thing just across from where they just put in the new rest area. So in 2014, when I moved back here to my hometown from Savannah, it had occurred to me that there was nothing commemorating this incident anywhere. So I go to the state of Florida, I go to the Department of Transportation, and I say, I'm going to crowdfund this. I'm going to put up a statue, memorial, something. They don't want to know. I always got the impression that the state really just had no interest in even acknowledging this had ever happened,
Dang.
But I was like Tim Robbins in the Shawshank Redemption. I wrote two letters a week until I finally got somewhere. Anyway, we crowdfunded this thing in It's a granite thing. It's about 6 feet tall with a big bronze plaque on it, with all the names of all the 35 people who perished, and a relief of the bridge. It was $10,000 in citizens. When, you know, I kicked in a little bit, but Steve Yera gave us some money. The Pilots Association gave us some money. And it was just regular folks who said, yeah, this sounds like something that we need to have. So we dedicated it on May the 9th, 2015, which was the 35th anniversary of the incident. And there were about 300 people there, including a lot of families, victims, family members. Some people came from Canada. I found as many as I could find. I mean, some of those trails had gone dry after some of the years. The state, I should say, finally sort of said, okay, they still have $1,000 of mine in case they have to move it. You know, I got to pay for that. But they, God Jeez. Love you, state of Florida.
Yeah.
But they have since installed a little sidewalk, a couple of palm trees. They've grassed it in and put like observation, you know, benches where, you know, to sit in. In other words, they made a little thing out of it. It used to just be like shell and scrub by the rocks there. And but they have since built all this around it. So I think maybe perhaps they've embraced it. I hope they don't have to move it, but you know, they got my money if they do.
What was the effect on the captain?
John's story is so sad, Chad. His wife left him. That's the first thing, basically because he was a pariah and also was pretty doomy and gloomy at this point. After a few years, he accepts a, he had gone to the SUNY Maritime Academy in New York, really. And I spoke to a lot of his best friends who were his friends for life from those days, talking about the way he thought, you know. He accepted an offer to go back to SUNY and teach basic seamanship for a couple of semesters up in, it's in between Bronx and the Queen and the Bronx and Queens. So he did that. And it was the admiral there. I spoke to him, actually. He's retired, of course, but he was the same guy who had brought the Exxon Valdez guy. If anybody can remember his name, because I can't. Captain somebody. He had taught there. Because he had also gone there, and the admiral said, I thought between him, Joseph Hazelwood, maybe was his name?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I thought between Hazelwood and Laro, they'd gone through so much that they could really impart some interesting stuff to these students. Anyway, Laro had started to develop multiple sclerosis by then. He couldn't pilot anymore. So he stayed for a semester and hated it. And quit. And essentially the rest of his life was a downward spiral. MS crippled him. He went back to University of South Florida and got a master's degree in counseling, was going to become a counselor. He worked on the suicide hotline and as a counselor for Hillsborough County Crisis Center. The disease finally took its toll on him and he just couldn't function anymore. And that's ultimately what killed him. And because he was a lifelong Catholic, John blamed himself. You know, it haunted him. His friends told me that he talked about this every day. You know, sometimes his friend, John Hayes, who I met with up in North Carolina where he lives, said he would call me at 2-3 in the morning and just say, don't you think I could have taken this ship off to starboard and for years? Man. Yeah. So it was a very sad story.
Just guilt ridden. Losing the Skyway, what was the effect on Tampa Bay as far as transportation?
Well, funny you should ask. What they did was once the DOT drivers had established that Summit Ventures bow had not hit the other bridge, the eastern span, the one going north, and that took a little while. They just diverted traffic back onto that bridge. It was 2 days later. There was no traffic going either way from Friday through Sunday morning, but they diverted traffic going two ways over the old 1954 span while the governor and the head of the DOT tried to figure out what the hell to do, which is another story. Shipping traffic was backed up for 2 days. I think, you know, there were reports, I forget the number, but the port was losing like $1 million a day. So that's what happened. And the second bridge, the one that Bob Graham found in France, you know, that we all know and love, was finished in 87. And so they demolished, they got rid of the hanging part, the hanging Chad, if you will, pretty quickly.
No offense, Chad.
Yes, none taken.
Oh, yeah, the hang, there you go. So the people, a lot of people remember driving, well, north or south on the other bridge and looking over and seeing that broken span over there. I remember it very, very well. And so it was 7 years before. And then they, I think it was 92, they demolished what was left of it, except for the fishing piers, which, you know, are pretty much still there.
Mm-hmm. Have any or were any permanent safety changes made, protocols, anything done regulatory that, that would try and prevent this from happening again?
Yeah, I think with regard to vehicular traffic, there are warnings. First of all, you have to remember there were no lights on the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, on the old bridge. A lot of people talk to me about this all the time. And I remember when I was a teenager learning to drive and being stupid, going over that bridge at midnight, 1, 2 in the morning. And you had to hope the moon was out because you couldn't see a damn thing. There were no lights on that bridge. So that's one thing, obviously, they fixed. But they put in vehicular warning signs. Damn, you know, and the wind thing happened, you know, yeah. High winds. More importantly, I think, for maritime traffic, they moved the, if you look at the photographs, the bridge that's there now, we still call it the new bridge, is something like 1,000 yards to the east of where the old one was. That was because there was a dogleg turn that ships had to make. This was part of Laro's problem. It gets complicated, but they straightened that out. So in other words, if you're in the shipping channel, now you can go straight through the bridge instead of having to make this really awkward turn. And the most notable thing, obviously, are the islands, what they call dolphins. They spent $44 million. It's like a big bumper pool table down there. So if anything happens to come through it, hopefully those things will deflect it. We've all seen them in the water there, just surrounding the main piers of the bridge.
You mentioned you were in Tampa at the time. What do you remember about hearing reports of this? I mean, you get news, radio, or TV, someone hit the bridge and there's, what do you remember about that day? And because this was obviously long before even cable TV, forget about internet or live on the scene reporting kind of
stuff. Well, you know, Chad, the Pony Express headed out to my house. I was working in the now long gone Pinellas Square Mall at the time. I grew up in St. Petersburg. I was born here. So I was working in a record store there, which is my other great passion, music and records and stuff. What I remember is going in probably around 8:45, 9 o'clock through a wall of water. The storm was here by then, you know. Oh my, this was a big, nasty rainstorm. And hearing about, I don't know, somebody told me about it. And we all closed the store and walked down to JCPenney's where they had that sort of wall of television sets, you know. And where the same channel is on everything, you see it big, small, and London, whatever, and watching. I'm sure it was WTBT because good old Jewel McGee had the very first the first microwave radar where they could do live reports from the field. And Neil Vecino was actually out in a rowboat, hunkered down with this rain thing over his head in the water with Jewel and his camera. And some adventure was right there. The tugboats had pulled it away from the bridge as far as the anchor chain would go until they could figure out what they were going to do with it. And Neil and Jewel were out there reporting from maybe 25 feet away from the anchored ship. And you could see it's about 80 feet of roadway draped across the bow. I mean, it's right there. And they eventually got chased out of there, you know, but it was such chaos in the first hour or so. Nobody knew what the heck was going on. And that's what I remember, is watching that. And, you know,
and they had dive teams. They had dive teams go out too,
right? The dive teams came out, and there's some really emotional stories from some of the divers who went on the scene and went into the bus. And some guys that I only met after I wrote the book. I spoke to some other divers early on. And yeah, anybody who was, it's that President Kennedy has been shot moment for Tampa Bay. It's like, where were you when you heard this, and how did it affect you? And some people have very, very emotional stories about their own experiences.
What was the height of the bridge where it collapsed?
150 feet.
Gosh, imagine.
Over water. It's 190 now. I mean, technically it might be 200, but they usually say 190. That was another. Oh, you know what? You're talking about safety measures. That's one thing I should mention, because ships were getting larger. Container ships were just starting to come in here then. But the gap between piers was 800 feet in 1980. The new bridge is 1,000 feet. They widened it. It's wider and it's higher. Mm-hmm.
What did you mean when you said Bob Graham had found it in France? I don't know that story.
Oh, that style of bridge is called a cable stayed bridge. In other words, it's sort of like a bootlace. Those cables are tied up in that pylon, the pylons that go straight up, as opposed to a suspension bridge. And that was pioneered in France over the Breton River. I think you pronounce it. Governor Graham, if you're listening, you can correct me. but so they at first they were just going to rebuild it. You know,
wow, the same bridge. They were going to build the same bridge.
Just going to rebuild the span. Oh, but I interviewed Governor Graham, and he was telling me. He said, "You know, it occurred to me first of all that was an outdated and kind of ugly bridge, and second of all, anybody who drove over it was always going to flash back to this thing." He was in France and had seen this design and said, "This, it's very elegant and it's strong and it's modern and it's going to last a long time." He was the one that brought the idea back.
Yeah. Well, so when was the Skyway Bridge, the bridge that collapsed, opened? It couldn't have been too long.
The bridge, the span that collapsed opened in 1971.
Jeez.
We've been asking.
10 years. Yeah.
The other one had been there since 54. It was fast-tracked in the 60s because Governor Burns, basically, they were anticipated. They'll always talk to you. This is another thing I found out. They'll always talk to you about. They built the second span because tourism was increasing. There was so much more traffic around Tampa Bay. That's not true. They built the second span because Governor Burns was in bed with Walt Disney, and they wanted all roads to lead to Disney World. And that's entirely why they did it. You had to have four lanes for the interstate to go through there. And that's what, and the old Skyway Bridge was just two lanes. So instead of knocking it down, building a four-lane bridge, they did the cheap thing. They got the blueprints out of the closet, and they just built a clone right next to it. And it was supposed to open in 69, but there was a serious flaw in their, what they call their bottom boring data. They put the piers in the wrong place because they were doing it so fast and so cheap. It leaned, and that was in 69. It cost them an extra, I think it was $3 million, and that's why it didn't happen until 71. It's a and I'll close with this too. The other thing is, if you look at photographs from 54, from 71, that bridge was never protected from ships. It's amazing when you consider that both spans of the Sunshine Skyway were built as a for massive, you know, seagoing vessels to go under back and forth to the port of Tampa and the port of Manatee. They had 2x4s lashed to the wooden pilings, like you'd have under the Treasure Island Bridge, so you don't bump it. You know, we're talking 20, 30, 40,000 ton ships. And I always tell people this when I do talks, every time any one of us drove over the old Sunshine Skyway Bridge, we were taking our lives into our own hands, because it was just by the grace of God that this didn't happen a lot earlier. That's another reason they put these huge concrete bumper pulls.
Bumpers, yeah.
One last thing for me, and this has been fascinating. I have enjoyed every minute of it. Tampa 1980, obviously a great difference from what it is now. What, you know, the Buccaneers didn't come along until 76. You know, this is the same year as the Mariel boat lift. So, you know, this is Florida is really starting to kind of take off on its
Liberty, you know, City riots. You know, it was,
What was Tampa in 1980 like?
I don't know. I've been in St. Petersburg all my life, Chad.
Indulge me. What was the Bay Area then?
I don't travel in Tampa circles too much, and you'll understand why. Craig will explain why. What was the Bay Area? You know, it was much simpler. I was always a music writer, so we were just starting to get big concerts then. Traditionally, artists didn't come to Florida because it's out of the way and you couldn't route yourself through there. It all has to do with money, of course. I'm trying to think of what it was like then, just a simpler time. And I think we all took the Sunshine Skyway for granted. It was just another road out of town. I don't think anybody really thought about the possibility that something, this is the worst ship bridge collision, catastrophe in world history. 35 people perished in terms of fatalities. And in a way, I think we all thought we lived in Mayberry at the time. You know, I mean, the Showboat Dinner Theater was here. I mean, that was the height of entertainment in those days. The Buccaneers had just come. The rowdies were starting to happen then. You know, you'd go to the Bayfront Center, and the Skyway Bridge was just another thing. It's like nobody thought about it. It's sort of like that distant, you know, you're that weird, slightly weird older brother who just lives out there somewhere in the hinterland. You don't think about until one day he picks up an axe and murders the town. Oh my God, that bridge fell down. That's the way I think about it. I don't know if that made any sense at all, but there.
No, no, that yeah,
it does.
Yeah,
Bill my DeYoung, older brother is not like that.
Bill DeYoung has been our guest. BillDeYoung.com online. He's written the book Skyway: The True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down. If you want to get into this story at the molecular level, that's what you need to read. Bill works right now for the St. Pete Catalyst, a news outlet there in the Bay Area, St. Pete specifically. Don't want to throw Tampa on your on your head there, Bill.
Love you, Tampa.
Before we go, I just wanted to ask, did you say you were writing a play?
I did write a play, actually. I wrote a one-person play that I did not act in. Thank you very much. It's called Mayday, Captain Laro and the Skyway Bridge. And for 90 minutes, John Laro comes out and tells you what he went through. And we just produced it here in St. Pete at Studio Grand Central. And I think there's a production in Stuart, Florida next month. And I took it from a lot of the interviews. I never spoke to him. A lot of the interviews that he did, a lot of the things his friends told me, a lot of the things that I knew the way I figured I knew the way he thought. And he just told his story about the MS and invoked God a lot. And, you know, it was dramatic and powerful. Yes, I did. Yeah. And thanks for asking. Wow.
Great. Wow. Bill, thank you so much for your insights.
Guys, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Greg, Bill was talking about, you know, people being able to remember driving over the one half of the Skyway and looking at the collapsed half. And you remember that.
I remember that. I was living in Pensacola when the crash happened, but then I moved down to Englewood, and to get there, I was driving a van and pulling a you know, like a little trailer with my belongings in it. And the when you first got to the old Skyway, what you're seeing is basically this big like a Lego structure where you could actually kind of see down to the water from the roadbed. It was scary just doing that. And then you notice you're paralleling this other bridge that all of a sudden it stops in midair and you're like, oh, shoot. You know, it was scarier than any roller coaster ride I've ever been.
I still look at the pictures and get a chill down my spine. It looks like the poster for a disaster movie. Dwayne The Rock Johnson stars in the Skyway collapse. And, you know, sadly, 35 people lost their life. You know, there's nothing funny about it, but it is just straight out of Hollywood and out of so many people's worst fears about driving over bridges and having them collapse. So as promised, we will finish this episode. This is the ship to shore call from the Summit Venture and the captain to the Coast Guard. Once the captain has realized he hit the pier and the span has collapsed. This is Florida's Hindenburg SOS call. Unbelievable.
Mayday, 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 Coast Guard. Mayday, 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 Coast Guard. Vessel calling, Mayday, vessel in distress. This is United States Coast Guard, St. Petersburg, Florida. Request your position, nature of distress, and number of persons on board. Over.
This is it. All the emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge. Vessel just hit the Skyway Bridge. The Skyway Bridge is down. Get all emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge. The Skyway Bridge is down. There's a Mayday emergency situation. Stop the traffic on that Skyway Bridge.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what size is the vessel that hit the bridge? Over.
The large vessel. Stop the traffic on the Skyway Bridge. There are some people in the water. Get emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge now.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what vessel are you on? Over.
Adventure, Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what is the size of your vessel and can you assist? Over.
Cannot assist with 606 feet long white draft. We cannot assist. We are in our apartment. Stop all the traffic on the bridge. Send some vessels out here to render assistance. People are on fire.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger. Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, where did the people come from that are in the water? Over.
On the bridge.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, request you stand by 16. Do not shift to any other frequency.
Stand by.
I'm Adventure, Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Did either span of the Skyway go down into the water? Over.
Westbound.
Roger, the whole west span, over.
The west span is down in the water.